thank you very much for coming. It is an enormous pleasure to welcome you to the plenary lecture of the American Society for Legal History. And before introducing our speaker, I would like to give our warmest thanks to Tulane University for making it possible for us to be here, and also for sponsoring the outdoor reception afterwards, which I'm told is very easy to get to. We'll just go downstairs and out the way that you came in, and you'll see it. Don't keep going. It's in a place called Pocket Park. We owe special thanks to Tulane President Michael Fitz, who offered to co-sponsor the lecture and reception before the conference was even in its earliest stages of planning. And then Tulane stuck with us even after all of the disruptions that they experienced with Hurricane Ida earlier this year. So we're very grateful. And I also want to thank Beth Brown, who is his chief of staff. Thanks also to Sally Brown Richardson, the A.D. Freeman Professor of Civil Law and Vice Dean for Academic Affairs at Tulane Law School, who helped with the logistics of this plenary lecture. And also I want to thank Dean David Meyer of the Tulane Law School, who is here, I believe, somewhere where we might be able to recognize him. I'm sure he's on his way. And welcome, of course. Thanks also to the History Department of Tulane University, which also is a co-sponsor of the plenary and reception. Finally, a warm welcome to all Tulane faculty who are here. And of course, to all the ASLH members who braved some challenging travel conditions and other challenges to be here in person. It's exciting to see you all. Thank you very much for coming. I am thrilled to introduce now John Fabian Witt, the Allen H. Duffy Class of 1960 Professor of Law at Yale Law School. John is a prolific and distinguished legal historian who has published on an impressive variety of history topics. His many books include The Accidental Republic, Crippled Working Men, Destitute Widows, and the Remaking of American Law, which was awarded the 2005 James Willard Hearst Prize from the Law and Society Association. A great many of you will know his 2012 Lincoln's Code, The Laws of War in American History, which received the Bancroft Prize and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. John has published articles in a great many law review and history journals and has penned public history commentary in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and many other outlets. And in just the last few years, in fact, since the time when I invited him to come and give this plenary lecture, he's published two more books, one presenting the discovery that he and Will Smiley made in the National Archives when they found the lost treatise on the laws of war by Francis Lieber, and a second that came out with astonishing speed in the wake of the first wave of the pandemic, called American Contagions, Epidemics and the Law from Smallpox to COVID-19, and that came out in 2020. So this is a publication rate that is humbling for the rest of us, but also, I think, inspiring, so thank you. And I should note that John graciously accepted the invitation to present in what now seems like ancient history, and was a very good sport about postponing the lecture when we couldn't meet in person last year. And I also should note that at the time that I invited him to speak to us, we were not yet Yale colleagues. John was at Yale, but I was not. I was a mere John Witt fan in those days. And who cannot admire someone who has written so eloquently about the legal history of torts, war, cosmopolitans, constitutions, and even empire. So we welcome him today to present Garland's Million, The Tragedy and Triumph of Legal History. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Laurie. That was too much. It was a really a generous introduction. I'm grateful. Thanks. I think this was first hatched at a breakfast in Nashville many years ago, as I recall. So I'm glad to be here. Thanks too to the heroic program chairs, Kristen Collins and Ari Bryan, who I know went through years of work to make this happen. And it really has been a fabulous conference already, and I'm looking forward to tomorrow. Thanks also to all of you who came. This was a challenging year to come, and I'm glad to have an audience, although I was committed to going forward whether there was anyone in the audience or not. And maybe most of all, welcome to the graduate students and new first-time attenders of this conference. It's a conference, I think, that aspires to be the best of scholarly conferences, which is to say welcoming and rigorous both at once. And in my experience, it does as well or better than most in accomplishing those things. So welcome to you, and I hope you have as many years of enjoying these conferences as I've been able to now. It's no understatement to say that this is the organization in which I've grown up as a scholar, from early conferences attended when I was a graduate student to the present. I've now watched mentors and heroes offer plenary lectures here. This is the five past lecturers, who are Laura Kelman, Laurie Benton, Tomiko Brown-Nagin, Ariella Gross, and Alejandro de la Fuente, and Annette Gordon-Reed. Wow. Their lectures give you some sense of the amazing range and depth of the field, comparative, international, ranging across time and space, court-centered sometimes, but always with political and social mobilizations outside the courts. They are what my 12-year-old would call absolute legends. And so I'm humbled to give this lecture today, and I do so totally awestruck by my predecessors. For longer than I care to admit, I've been writing a book occasioned by an unusual Harvard undergraduate, this man named Charles Garland, who upon turning 21 in June of 1920, refused his share of his wealthy father's estate. The inheritance amounted to about $1 million, which would be about $14 million today, adjusted for inflation. Private property, he said, is the principal cause of our unrest and unhappiness, and so he refused to take the inheritance. He became something of a press sensation. Observers asked, some ironically, others hysterically, whether the Russian Revolution was coming to Boston. Others, like Roger Baldwin, had different ideas. Baldwin, who'd founded the ACLU earlier the same year, and Upton Sinclair in Los Angeles, but the radical gadfly and author of The Jungle, got together and wrote to Garland, accept the money, they told him, and donate it to a board of advisors who would use it to undo the unrest and unhappiness that so frustrated young Garland. Over the course of the next year, Baldwin successfully persuaded Garland to do just that. In 1922, Baldwin incorporated the American Fund for Public Service, better known as the Garland Fund, with a mandate to make contributions for the benefit of mankind. The board, recruited by Baldwin, resolved to use its money primarily to support producers' movements of organized labor on the one hand, and the protection of minorities on the other. Over the next 7 years, the fund's resources would grow in the booming stock market of the 1920s and become almost $2 million by the end. Here then, in our terms, is the question that they faced every month when they gathered. How would you invest, what about $28 million to change the world today? Now, to be clear, this amount was a drop in the bucket. By the early 1920s, Andrew Carnegie and his estate had donated some $350 million. The Rockefeller Foundations had already, by this point, given away some $575 million. Big philanthropy was a phenomenon, as it is again today in our time. And the Garland Fund was not it. The Garland Fund grant, however, occasioned a distinctively generative set of conversations. The directors asked a fundamental question about how to make change. They wanted to know what levers might alter the basic operations of an exploitative and oppressive world. The goal, as they put it, was no less than to free people's minds from the bonds of old institutions. The fund spent its resources down at a rapid clip. It didn't want to be a perpetual fund. It wanted to be a short-term operation. By the end of the decade, the directors decided on one last big effort. Over considerable internal dissent, more on that later, they announced a final substantial gift in 1930, a grant to the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP, initially set at more than $200,000 and then reduced to about $100,000. The money would launch a campaign of lawsuits against Jim Crow, especially in the public schools of the American South. Now, in the end, the money, the $100,000, was never forthcoming. The stock market crash took away what the boom market of the 20s had given. Ultimately, the grant amounted to a little bit less than $30,000. Nonetheless, for a quarter century, lawyers like Charles Hamilton Houston, Thurgood Marshall, Constance Baker Motley, and Jack Greenberg carried forward the campaign, dedicating to that effort the resources of the NAACP and later the Legal Defense Fund. In 1954, of course, this effort culminated in the famous decision of Brown against Board of Education, ruling that state-compelled segregation in public schooling is unconstitutional. This audience hardly needs me to tell them much about it. It's safe to say it's perhaps the most famous moment in the last century of American law. Now, nearly 70 years later, that campaign and its outcome deliver a cruel disillusionment about law's failures and law's limits. For decades, America's schools have been growing more segregated, not less. Economic inequality is still nakedly distributed along racial lines. Black lives are at risk from violence and health inequities and poverty. Brown's glow has dimmed, it's fair to say. So what do we do with tarnished idols? What do we do when ideals fail? This evening, I want to persuade you that the flawed project of the Garland Fund and Brown Against the Board are tragedies and triumphs of a kind characteristic to legal history. They are quintessential examples of the kind of broken success that the law makes available and that legal history helps us see. As a social practice, law lies in the space to draw on the brilliant Harvard political theorist Brandon Terry, between irony and romance, a space that Terry associates with a desperate mix of tragedy and possibility, both always at once, tragedy and possibility. We shouldn't be surprised to see the failure of idealistic visions or the undoing of righteous conceptions of justice in the history of the law. We should expect tragedy, and not just because the world is full of evil, even though it is, but because the compromise, the tarnish, the at best tragic realization of ideals is built into the mechanisms of the law. It is what the law does. For nearly 100 years now, critics have lambasted the American Fund. Upon the fund's opening in 1922, the New York Times called it a criminal enterprise. The American Federation of Labor and Samuel Comper soon denounced it as out and out revolutionary, pro-Soviet, and pro-communist. The Chamber of Commerce gleefully took up the cudgel that labor had provided to bash the fund's efforts. Government got into the act too. The House Military Affairs Committee warned in 1926 that the fund was made up of communists and pacifist plotters. Congressman Martin Dies, famously of the Dies Committee, blasted the fund as part of a dangerous world of Soviet-inspired radicalism. His House Un-American Activities Committee carried on his campaign against what it called the Red Garland Fund. Anti-communist culture warriors bashed the fund as a central node in a nefarious red network aimed at the destruction of free government, religion, the home, and all the institutions of American civilization. All the institutions of American civilization. But we need not listen only to detractors and critics on the right. The fund's own directors had little good to say about their own organization. Baldwin bemoaned the fund as mostly having given blood transfusions to dying organizations. His unpublished autobiography proclaimed the fund a failure. at mid-century, board members remembered the experience as having largely been negative. One recalled the fund as a, quote, object lesson in futility, and another director observed a total lack of enthusiasm among the board's directors. Black labor organizer A. Philip Randolph, who received grants from the fund, privately and uncharitably called the entire project irrefutable evidence of a mental nut. And those whose grant applications failed were unsurprisingly even less charitable. Charles Garland himself, well, Garland, who had little involvement in the fund's operation, could only bring himself to say at the fund's winding down in 1941 that it didn't, in the end, cut much ice. He objected in particular to its gifts to the NAACP as insufficiently radical. Scholars haven't had much good to say about the fund either. An older generation of liberal historians lauded its efforts. Richard Kluger saw the fund's beginnings as the beginning of a kind of simple justice project in mid-20th century America. Merle Curdy portrayed the fund as a notable chapter in the long effort of liberal progress. But more recently, the fund's historians have been less generous. Risa Goluboff and Mark Tushnet cite it as a cautionary example and charge it with imposing undue limits on conceptions of race equality. The incisive political scientist Megan Francis asserts that the lure of Garland Fund money captured the mainstream of the civil rights movement and turned it away from lynching and racial violence and black lives, leading scholars like Kate Andreas, Ken Mack, and Ben Sachs echo Francis. They follow in the footsteps, too, of W.E.B. Du Bois, who left the NAACP shortly after the inception of the Brown campaign, declaring famously that black children needed neither segregated schools nor mixed schools, but instead an education. Du Bois' view stands in for a generation, generations plural, of black critics, ranging from Du Bois' contemporary, the sociologist Ralph Bunche, to founding critical race theorist Derrick Bell, and to a host of critical race scholars and historians today. Who were then these much maligned founders and directors of the Garland Fund? Well, meeting monthly in Greenwich Village, sometimes on Washington Mews, which you can see here, beginning in late 1922, the board consisted of about a dozen people at any given time. Its composition changed modestly, but not very much, across the course of the fund's main decade of operation. But there was a core cast of characters. In addition to Baldwin, who was the fund's dominant figure throughout its life, the board included NAACP leader and man of arts and letters, James Weldon Johnson, former Wobbly and iconoclastic labor radical, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, perennial Socialist Party president, presidential candidate, Norman Thomas, New Deal power broker, Sidney Hillman of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America and later the Congress of Industrial Organizations. Hillman served on the board in its early years. So did two editors of the Liberal Nation magazine, Louis Gannett and Frieda Kirchway, as well as Chicago social worker Mary McDowell. Crusading labor lawyer Frank Walsh was one of the fund's incorporators, and lawyer Morris Ernst, most famous for his civil liberties work in defense of James Joyce's Ulysses, sat on the board as well. So did a small cadre of communists and sometimes communists, including labor organizer William Z. Foster, American Communist Party founder Benjamin Gitlow, and Boston heiress Clarina Michelson. Now, around the fund's board circled influential liberal and progressive advisors, including Harvard's Felix Frankfurter, the philosopher John Dewey, birth control advocate Margaret Sanger, Unitarian minister and pacifist John Haynes Holmes, public health activist Alice Hamilton, and essayist Walter Lippmann. Now, some of you will recall the venerable historian's question, where did progressivism go? Well, here's part of an answer. Many of the leaders of this fund, many of its advisors and counselors, and some of progressivism's energies wound up in and around the Garland Fund conference table. And for a decade, these members and their advisors argued and fought, and sometimes productively and sometimes bitterly, over what kind of change to make and how to accomplish it. Revolution, of course, which was the goal for some of the directors, is hard. And given the number and intensity of the critics, perhaps it's no surprise to you that many of the fund's projects were abject failures. Maybe even most of them were. Right out of the box, the fund gave $55,000 to a socialist paper, the New York Call, which folded within months. The fund made big loans for strike relief, strikes failed, and the fund's money disappeared. Labor organizers fled to the Soviet Union rather than appeal criminal convictions, costing the fund $40,000 in bail money. At least one completely fraudulent organization absconded with tens of thousands of dollars to deepest Minnesota, never to be seen again. And any number of other funding efforts came to no good. What of the charges by the right that the fund was a communist plot? The fund was by any measure an organization of the left. Its resources typically went to the left wing of the American labor movement, sponsoring eclectic socialist and industrial union leaning efforts. Its debates usually featured much of the usual left sectarian infighting, though Baldwin's charisma and energy and the fund's initially ample resources allowed it to let a thousand flowers bloom and to avoid the worst of the internecine conflict of the left. And in the fund's waning days, when Charles Garland reasserted influence over the fund and when other directors had lost interest, the last few thousand dollars of funding fell largely under the control of a Soviet spy named Harold Ware, the most famous and perhaps known to you as Whitaker Chambers' handler, a man who directed money to late 1930s communist efforts at agricultural radicalism. But the internal organization of the fund was actually carefully designed to limit and constrain the influence of the party. Baldwin and Johnson and others fought from early on against certain kinds of communist tactics on the board itself, and the big grant decision in 1930 to award funds to the NAACP, for example, was made by self-consciously circumventing subversive tactical efforts by the Communist Party elements of the board. What then of the charge that the Garland Fund and the NAACP campaign was unduly legalistic? Now, versions of this critique have circulated in evaluations of the fund's work from the 1920s to the present. Today, they form one of the most powerful criticisms of the Brown decision itself. And in this view, a formal lawyer's conception of equal protection asserted itself and suppressed deeper substantive efforts at practical equality. Now, as it happens, few in the 1920s were more skeptical of change through the courts than members of the fund board. The Supreme Court, after all, had put Eugene Debs in prison not once, but twice. People like Flynn, Baldwin, Foster, Nearing, and Gitlow had long preached about the dangers of working through state institutions of any kind, let alone the courts. Baldwin had been disillusioned a decade earlier when his efforts at democratic reform in progressive era St. Louis helped produce racial segregation ordinances and race riots. Courts in particular seemed like implausible pathways to revolutionary change, since for so long they had seemed to be partisans of capital and of white supremacy. These were the institutions that had delivered Plessy and Lochner and Hitchman Cole. Courts had produced the labor injunction and wielded antitrust laws against unions. And so it should be no surprise that the fund's efforts were directed almost entirely towards sources of transformative change outside the courts and indeed outside the state entirely. The fund's first award, August 1922, strike relief for the United Mine Workers, District Number 2, striking in western Pennsylvania. Over the next years, the largest category of funding, constituting more than a quarter of the fund's grants over its lifetime, went to periodicals and publications such as the New York publishing house Vanguard Press and the labor-oriented news service Federated Press. The fund gave large sums to the ill-fated New York Call and another socialist weekly, the Oklahoma Leader. Grants went to the Daily Worker, to A. Philip Randolph's monthly The Messenger, and to the magazine Labor Age, which was affiliated with the League for Industrial Democracy, a kind of American version of the British Fabian Society, to which Baldwin and Dewey and Du Bois, James Farmer, Walter Lippmann, A.J. Musty, and Reinhold Niebuhr all belonged at one time or another. The Christian socialist magazine The World Tomorrow received grant money, as did the New Masses, which was the successor to the pre-war literary and political journal, more famous than the New Masses, the Masses itself. A fifth of the fund's resources went to the second largest funding category, which was workers' education, including large grants to the astounding and forgotten Brookwood Labor College in Katona, New York, which helped train and inspire any number of future members and organizers of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, along with the Socialist Rand School in Manhattan, the Denver Labor College, Commonwealth College in Arkansas, the Workers' School in New York, and the United Mine Workers' education efforts in Pennsylvania. Educational propaganda efforts received substantial grants, too, including a speaker service modeled on George Creel's World War I-era Committee on Public Information. Significant shares of Garland's money went to research, too, on subjects like imperialism and labor injunctions. Other areas of funding included strike relief, farm organizations, producer cooperatives, workers' health, trade unions, and legislative campaigns, even a traditional progressive-style defense of the constitutionality of the minimum wage published here by the New Republic. Now, none of these projects were narrowly legal in their orientation. Even the substantial support for legal defense by the fund was not legalistic in the sense that critics usually mean. Legal defense efforts were rooted in a pre-war and wartime tradition of defense efforts by the Wobblies and others to defend off the state, not to affirmatively use it. The fund helped pay for Clarence Darrow's services in the Scopes Evolution case in Tennessee. It supported the campaign to clear Sacco and Vanzetti, the anarchists whose Boston area conviction for murder the Garland Fund helped make a cause celeb on the left. They subsidized criminal defense lawyers for communists, including Foster, a member of their board, charged with criminal syndicalism, and they provided bail money to any number of labor radicals through the 1920s. In the end, only 5% of Garland resources went to black organizations. That's the purple slice right there. And only a small fraction of that went to the litigation campaign. The first NAACP grant, one of the very first made by the fund, went not to desegregation efforts, but to the extraordinary 1922 anti-lynching campaign in the newspapers. More generally, nearly three-fifths of Garland grants to black organizations went to labor organizing, which you can see here in the green slices, labor organizing, either labor organizing or legal defense here, three-fifths if I combine the green and the red. That was an NAACP legal defense fund put to use, among other ways, in the successful representation of Dr. Ossian Sweet and his family. The Sweets, as you may know, had been charged with homicide in the defense of their home against a white mob in Detroit. The fund paid for Clarence Darrow again. We add support for black publications, the orange slice, with the anti-lynching piece, the blue slice. Three-quarters of the fund's nearly $100,000 in awards to black agencies went to projects other than the litigation campaign. And we can go a step further. As we shall see in a moment, in 1928 and 29, the fund undertook efforts to support the organizing of labor in the South, efforts that were understood crucially to be about the race problem in the United States. If we include these grants here in blue as a share of total grants to black organizations and Southern labor organizing, the NAACP litigation campaign falls to less than 20% of the resources dedicated by the fund to support for racial minorities. Ultimately, the litigation campaign for which the Garland Fund is now principally known used a mere 3% of the resources deployed by the fund in its 20-year existence. Desegregation through the courts was just one part, and a tiny part at that, of a much larger strategic project to break the ideological bounds of 1920s America. Baldwin, in particular, conceived of the fund as the affirmative side of his negative ACLU, negative rights-oriented ACLU, setting the agenda and entering the battle to upset what he called the colossal power of the myths that controlled American social life. Through workers' education, publishing efforts, magazines, newspapers, and news services, the directors had entered into a struggle over the kinds of public opinion and ideological structures about which thinkers around the Atlantic world had started in the 1910s and 20s to write, ranging from Karl Mannheim in Germany and Walter Lippmann in the US to Antonio Gramsci in Italy and Norman Angell and Graham Wallace in the UK. The project for the fund was to alter the landscape of strategic action and make possible kinds of politics that have been removed to the margin of American life. All of which produces a kind of puzzle. Why does an organization that was almost entirely dedicated to goals of fundamental structural and ideological change, one that was suspicious of engaging the state, and that was engaged in a sophisticated critique of ideological forms of power, why would such an organization come to have a legacy of narrowly legal reform? Now, part of the answer, I think, is that the ideological efforts of one small foundation were swamped by the sheer amount of culture in a country, a teeming country of 100 million people. In all, Garland's directors spent about $1 million on education and publishing. The fund produced just one short film in the span of 2 decades, an innovative but modest melodrama about the Passaic textile mill strike of 1926. By the end of the 1920s, Hollywood's three major studios were spending over $110 million each year, releasing more than 350 films annually. The fund's most successful early interventions reached minds by turning events into propaganda, what Walter White, eventually the leader of the NAACP, called highly spectacular dramatizations. The NAACP's anti-lynching bill may have failed in the Congress, but NAACP leaders believed that the Garland Fund-financed campaign of newspaper advertisements had altered public opinion and sharply reduced the number of lynchings in the middle of the 1920s. The Tennessee Evolution case had become a nationwide media spectacle. The defense of Ossian Sweet had publicized residential segregation in northern cities in the Great Migration. The groundswell of support for Sacco and Vanzetti had galvanized the left in the 1920s, as the Scottsboro episode would in the 1930s. But such moments illustrate a crucial and telling caution. Sensational events have to capture attention. Change requires appealing to the world as it should be, and also engaging audiences as they are, taking the world as it is, at least in part, and entrenching some, or maybe even most, of its existing features. The world's structures and interests screen for the kinds of messages and the kinds of projects that will be attention-getting and mind-shaping. Dreaming about change in the research and publishing branches of the Garland Fund was one thing. Altering minds, perhaps millions of minds, was entirely another. Dreaming in the world means compromise with injustice. It means loss of purity and the sacrifice of at least some righteous claims. For the fund's directors, an ugly truth was that their core mission to animate the labor movement was also the principal site of their biggest failures. The 1920s were the lean years for American labor, in Irving Bernstein's still evocative phrase. Union membership fell in absolute terms by a fifth during the early 1920s, continued to fall for a decade thereafter. Between 1923 and 1932, the number and scale of recorded labor actions dropped to levels not experienced since the middle of the 19th century. The fund's labor efforts stood out for their lack of success. The fund invested heavily in failed strikes in coal mines, in textile mills, in Passaic in 1926, in Gastonia in 1929, among New York's furriers and in the garment trades. At the end of the decade, Morris Ernst observed that the fund had been entirely unsuccessful in its efforts to aid union organizations by direct support. An uncharacteristically frustrated Baldwin wrote that the average American worker does not know that he has lost the right of free speech because he has nothing to say. Idealistic social projects meet the world almost instantly. As boxers sometimes say, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face, and the fund's labor efforts got hit and got hit hard. The Garland Fund, we remember, I propose to you, is a Garland Fund that had been punched in the face and altered, and was altered in the experience. In this respect, the history of the Garland Fund is characteristic of the history of the law more generally, a family of institutions and practices that are fundamentally about engaging with a world riven by violence and disagreement and imperfection and, yes, evil. To study it is to study dreams crushed, righteousness compromised, utopias dashed. Welcome, graduate students. To study law's history is to study human beings living together with a particular form of authority dedicated to dealing with the fact of bitter and persistent and ineradicable disagreement over facts and values and interests. And there's a structural reason why the most common narrative in the extraordinary outpouring of legal histories from this society and elsewhere over the past two decades, the most common narrative, the quintessential narrative, is one of lost promise. There's a reason for this. The law always delivers blows to at least one side, and sometimes all sides, of the disagreements it tries to manage. In 1929, fund directors like Baldwin were at their wits' end for how to spend the foundation's remaining money. The fortunes of labor, and especially its left wing, were dimmer at the end of the decade than they'd been when the fund had started. Inspiration for a path forward came from several directions. From the left, came a new focus on the South and on the Comintern theory of the Black Belt, which held that African Americans were best understood as a colonized people whose emancipation would look like decolonization. More practically, and I think it's fair to say more acutely, sympathizers with labor could see that racial division among American workers had badly hamstrung unionization efforts. American Federation of Labor Unions barred black workers from membership. Baldwin had learned about the consequences of racial division in the 1917 East St. Louis racial pogrom and in the failures of the Great Steel Strike of 1919. He'd had personal engagement with both. Strikes at textile mills in New England or the Mid-Atlantic faced the threat that mills would go to the non-unionized South. The great migration northward of millions of black Americans meant that a strike-breaking reserve labor pool increasingly lived across town. So starting in the second half of the 1920s, the fund began to direct its attention to black labor organizing. The directors financed the Trade Union Committee for Organizing Negro Workers, run by black Harlem socialist Frank Crosswaith. That was actually this slide. The button-down, the Vanguard Press published Scott Nearing's Black America, a fiercely argued critique of racism and inequality as tools of class control. The button-down National Urban League received a grant, so did the Scottsboro Defense Committee. And in the same moment, the fund took up a proposal to finance a challenge to Jim Crow schools in the American South. Now, of course, to historians today, this last example, an attack on school inequality in the Jim Crow South, doesn't belong in this list of labor and economic projects. What is the beginning of Brown against the Board doing alongside economic and labor mobilizations? As I've started to argue in a recently published exchange with Megan Francis, the fund's turn to black education had economic and labor roots. Du Bois, the most radical of the NAACP leaders in the late 1920s, had started the fund down the road to black education when he applied to study school inequality in the South in 1925 and 1926. Black Americans, he wrote at the time, form a large and increasingly important part of the laboring class of the United States. James Weldon Johnson argued to Baldwin that assisting black schools would allow black workers to, quote, become as rapidly as possible an integral factor in the industrial and labor world. A few years later, he appealed to his fellow directors by observing that 12 million black Americans were the nation's largest group of unorganized workers. Now, left-leaning fund directors worried that the NAACP had no labor program. Du Bois replied that grants to the crisis and the NAACP would lead the race into industrial democracy and emancipation from their present peonage. Du Bois supported the 1930 grant proposal by preparing a 10-page memorandum setting out the crisis's coverage of black workers' role in the American labor problem from its beginning into the end of the 1920s. Even a comparative moderate like Walter White joined the effort to appeal to labor and class interests. The fund's desegregation grant, he explained in 1930, aimed to establish conditions and a psychology which will put the Negro laborer on an equal basis with white labor. Even as the NAACP urged funding for its legal aid campaign, the organization pressed the AFL, without success, to include black workers in the Federation's organizing campaigns. "We face a crisis in interracial labor conditions," the NAACP told the AFL, "in which the black worker will soon be in a position to break any strike." The simultaneous schools grant brought to the surface sharp disagreements about class and race among the fund's directors. Baldwin asserted that class, not race, was the fundamental basis of oppression. Race prejudice, on his view, was a tool of the real villain, namely class exploitation. Johnson and Ernst disagreed, as they had throughout the 20s, but answered that the theoretical point didn't much matter. They could all agree that the race problem was a practical bottleneck in labor organizing. Negro wage workers, Ernst wrote to the fund in 1930, quoting director Scott Nearing's Black America, "carry the normal burden of workers under capitalism. And in addition, they must constantly pay the penalty for their blackness. They are exploited as a race as well as a class." The aim of the education campaign offered by Ernst and Johnson was to create conditions which may lead to a spontaneous outburst of Negro organization. Until America solved its race problem, they observed, putting money into the labor movement would be like pouring money down a sink. Now, the Ernst Johnson synthesis did not satisfy everyone. Critics on and off the board insisted that to reconstruct education, one must first reconstruct society. But the critics offered no path to any such reconstruction, and the counterargument was clear. The school program was designed precisely to find a way to begin such an effort, which must, after all, start somewhere, and which a decade of experiments in labor and elsewhere, experiments actually undertaken by the fund itself in the previous years, had failed to produce. And by 1930, the more heterodox left shared unusually wide agreement that the school equality dimensions of the NAACP's proposed campaign directly connected to the economic standing of the black community. An ACLU pamphlet issued in 1931 asserted that the new litigation project might reduce destructive economic rivalry between working class whites and black America, whose low standard of living had made them so hard to organize. For this reason and others, as Ken Mack has shown in his important work on civil rights lawyering, early critics of legalistic reform, black and white alike, joined in the NAACP campaign during the 1930s. The campaign itself was heterodox in the 1930s. The white lawyer whom the NAACP retained to develop and prosecute the legal campaign, Nathan Margold, worked to develop a legal theory that might support federal prosecutions of white rioters who'd violently chased black tenants away from farming land in Oklahoma. In 1932, White and Margold together, White, now the leader of the NAACP, began to develop model bills prohibiting race discrimination in employment by firms that contracted with federal, state, and local governments, bills that eventually began to come to fruition in executive orders during the Roosevelt and Truman administrations. By the mid-1930s, new federal funding for education also meant that the economic value of school equality was greater than the campaign's architects could possibly have guessed in 1930. In a way, the move to education equalization aimed to be a kind of force multiplier in the fund's cash-strapped campaign to change minds. The fund would make a comparatively tiny investment, and if it won, victory might allow it to capture the fiscal power of the state, redirecting the public treasury toward millions of black children and altering the education of tens of millions of white children, too. Here's how one could compete with Hollywood and the market: by capturing the state. Such a change might work a giant transformation of mind and reorient Americans' thinking on basic economic questions. Now, as you can tell, that's a long shot at best. But as one Baldwin memo put it in 1937, education seemed at that stage to be the most effective lever for challenging the system by which, for example, landlords continued to exploit tenant agricultural labor across the South. Education was economic radicalism on this account, though, to be sure, a radicalism that took a particular position in the debate on the left over working within the state. Now, historians of education and the law have debated for decades now whether the NAACP leaders were right in that conclusion. But White, Johnson, Houston, Baldwin, and the directors of the fund had a reason for the views at which they had arrived. Reasons often overlooked by historians today. For a decade, they had experimented with the alternatives: organizing, striking, propaganda, worker education, and these efforts hadn't stuck. Education, it seemed, might. Again, to engage a social structure as it exists, even when aiming for transformative change, is to be compromised. Education was a move made in a social structure that had cut off other moves. It was a path of least resistance. There was no version of the school equalization campaign that did not share this tragic structure. One conception of the school equality project famously aimed not so much to desegregate but to equalize funding. Early NAACP-supported versions of the school's campaign proposed salary and funding equalization, which garnered support from black teachers who were vital members of local NAACP chapters. Variations on such an approach have attracted activists from Du Bois in the mid-30s to the present. Even this approach, however, accepted a separateness that had been established for the purpose of promoting white supremacy. The tragedy of Nathan Margold's report for the NAACP, a report Francis fiercely calls infamous, is that it took stock of the existing structure of 1931 America and made a lawyer's judgment. A lawyer's judgment that a school funding equality litigation campaign could never work, at least not in the institutional setting and the political economy of Jim Crow. As a Felix Frankfurter protege from Harvard Law School, Margold saw that equal funding would require costly trials on fact-intensive questions in dozens and hundreds of differently situated school districts. Even assuming victory, enforcement would be a never-ending quagmire because white school officials in each district would aim to evade and backslide. Civil rights lawyers would be embroiled in literally thousands of ongoing lawsuits at any one time, no one of them ever ending, each involving its own local variations and messy circumstances. Now, Margold's fateful lawyerly move was to argue that a formal prohibition on compulsory racial separation in the public schools would make it harder for any one school district to allocate resources on the basis of race. If schools were for all, it would be hard to direct money, or at least harder, to white students over black ones. So let's pause here, because the point is crucial. Brown's rule against race segregation in this conception was not conceived in its origins in an effort to create formal equality or legalistic rights. It was rooted in a substantive, if desperate, economic vision for labor solidarities and built on a practical political economy of equality. And that's really something. Of course, education didn't stay still. The world doesn't stay still. The children who were conscripted to be shock troops in this litigation campaign ran headlong into massive resistance of the kind you're all familiar with. White politicians blocked the schoolhouse doors. Families fled into private academies and took refuge in residentially segregated school districts. Black migration to the North produced more residential segregation rather than less, and residential segregation crucially undid the delicate political economy of the Margold theory and the NAACP's campaign. What about those schools that were integrated? Well, the best estimates indicate that desegregation led to the displacement of nearly 40,000 black teachers and more than 2,000 black principals during the 25 years following Brown versus the Board in 1954, amounting to a loss of some $240 million in salary income each year in the early 1970s. The NAACP strategy, as prosecuted by Houston and eventually Marshall, Motley, Greenberg, and others, left open countermoves to Brown's critics, because of course it did. That's what it is to make change and register it in the law in the face of disagreement. You take what you can get and you try to persuade those you can reach, but those who disagree or want to stop you will make moves of their own. There is no non-horrific way around this stubborn fact. Law aims for a monopoly over the resolution of disputes that have no resolution without force. And to accomplish this aim, law lets in the opposing sides, angels and devils alike. Megan Francis is right. The world will capture efforts to transform it. We shouldn't expect otherwise, though the energies and genius and flaws of people like Baldwin and Johnson and Du Bois and Flynn will leave indelible marks. Legal history is the study of the struggle between the world as it ought to be and the world as it is. And as such, it's nearly always about the dialectic of capture and co-optation. Law mills passions into a grain that is, at best, grade B. Suited to a fallen world of pervasive difference and disagreement, law is moral visions, life projects, and social formations that leave their mark, but are also ground down and crushed by the weight of the world. One thing I think we can say at this point is that if Francis is right, then E.P. Thompson is wrong, in the famous quotation from his book some years back. The rule of law is not an unqualified human good. It is or may be a good, but it's essentially a tragic one. Its virtue, when it has virtue, rests in the admixture of solvents and solutes that forge a new alloy out of the divergent views of human beings. A world in which perfect justice could be achieved might not have law at all. And that's part of why law's rejection has virtues too, or can sometimes. The choice between law and something else is always situational and depends on just how unacceptable the law's engagement with evil is under the circumstances, and depends also on what the available options are. Now, what does this have to do with legal history and its study? The law's history records moral successes, no matter that they are compromised, as they will be, and it simultaneously records tragedy, because the law will never be more than incrementally better than the community from which it comes. In recent years, the Thompson claim has not weathered so well. It looks like a Cold War artifact, the product of one man's struggle with a totalitarian betrayal of the 20th century left, like a requiem for the dreams of the Garland Fund generation. More recently, the moral energy of our field cuts a different way. Historians of law, politics, and the state today focus on the past's responsibility for the crying injustices of the present, as if one is tempted to say responsibility for those injustices might lie anywhere else. In this now salient view, emphasis on the tragic, let alone the triumphant, no matter how qualified, seems to risk a kind of complacency. Tragedy and contingency can seem to be interpretive postures lacking a moral urgency adequate to the moment. This is all the more so because the stories we tell construct the people we are. We're always at risk when we talk of triumphs or when we accommodate ourselves to tragedy, of sowing surrender and subverting the passions and idealisms that promise to make the world better. No wonder critique is where the action is today. If I've been more successful than I expect this evening, however, I'll have persuaded you of one thing further. At the right time and place, the tragedy and triumph view is not only descriptively illuminating. At crucial junctures, stories of compromised triumphs hold at bay the specter of a paralyzing disillusionment. They sustain hope for an attainable collective future. They maintain human morale by setting daunting but possible, in Brandon Terry's words, possible expectations for chastened emancipations in our own time and in our futures. Such stories may not be the fuel with which to launch movements, but they may be a ballast in the perilous effort to stay afloat. Thank you very much for listening tonight. Sure. Questions? I think there's a microphone in the middle of the aisle, which Lori has set up, which I think will allow you to be captured in the recording. All right, let's go. That's...
John, thank you so much. That was awesome. So I wanted to ask you, I was thinking, I don't think Reese is here, but I wanted to... Especially when you were talking about triumphs and tragedies, it kept making me think of Reese's lost promise and that particular, which I think is a particular form of kind of that we maybe our generation is particularly fond of version of the legal history. It's tragic, but it's kind of also a little. You know, what might have been, right? The kind of the lost opportunity, the missed opportunity. It still leaves room for some hope because if things had gone a different way, if we could still take a different path. And she's going over a lot of kind of the same stuff with this story, and in particular, right, but in her version, education was the wrong path, and the path, not just the fund, but that the NAACP could have taken, that we all could have taken, was to more fully embrace and stay down the labor and worker and working class focus. And so I guess I'm both interested in hearing your comment on how you see your work, you know, challenging or complimenting, you know, how you think about it in relation to her story of the lost promise, but also about that version of legal history, which I really think a lot of us do, which is the kind of, it went this way, but it could have gone this other way, and we can still somehow pull ourselves back there.
Great question. Thank you, Ariella. And for sure, engaging with Risa is something that I want Risa's presence. Risa has arrived. Dean Golubov, engaging with Dean Golubov is something that I for sure am doing. And more generally, and I hope that came across at some junctures of the paper, engaging with the lost promise, the structure of the lost promise narrative, which is one that I think is a regular recurring feature of the kinds of conversations that we have. And I think in some respects, and I'm interested to hear how it strikes you, in some respects, the story I've tried to tell tonight is not so much a lost promise narrative. It's about strategies that were tried and which were crushed. That is to say, the labor strategies might have worked in the 20s and in early 30s. They were tried and they were failing. Not because they weren't tried. That's the Golubov version, is a mistake by the activists. Instead, there was a world that the activists encountered, a world of institutions and power structures, and that's what did the work. So in a way, I think the story cuts against certain versions of lost promise and is an invitation, and maybe a controversial one, which you might reject, an invitation to find, to observe in the path that was taken, tragedies and triumphs. Right? That was the invitation I issued, maybe electrically. I mean, maybe that's a complicated thing to do.
So my question is about E.P. Thompson, who, after all, some people think included that line about the universal good of the rule of law in order to annoy Orthodox Marxists. But one can think of, in that same chapter, his other slightly more nuanced argument, in which he says, he asks the question, why do the commoners go to the law at all in the 18th century? And his answer is, it's the mere possibility of justice that keeps people coming back to the law. And that would seem to me consistent with your story in a way. Is it?
Great. Two things to observe in that. The work that mere possibility is doing. So on the one hand, the mere possibility of justice is doing a kind of, let's call it ideological work. It's maintaining systems of status hierarchy and oppression by authorizing a path for change, or the appearance of a path for change in the form of possibility. That's one of the things going on there. But I also think that that there's more strategic canniness in people who are going to the law. They're making choices against a set of alternatives which are less appealing than the paths that they pursue. So I guess that embedded in that idea of people pursuing justice because it's possible is a couple different things. One, that the ideological piece, and then the other, it being the best available tool given the array of options before them. So both of those things. And of course, the Garland Fund isn't making the mistake of thinking that the law is the strategy. The Garland Fund is authoring these critiques that I'm echoing, and looking for ways around them that don't involve law at all, or at least not in the first instance.
Hi, I love this. I wanted to invite you to say a little more along the lines of this really great debate that you've been having, probably still ongoing, with your colleague Sam Moyne. Mm-hmm. And one of the points of the debate, as I understand it, is about the extent to which legal historians ought to be making causal claims as opposed to other kinds of claims. So I wondered if you could say a little bit more about the nature of any kind of causal claim that you've been making in this story. So I see you making an explanatory claim about a choice that we might have understood differently on the part previously on the part of the Garland Fund, and just a different way of thinking about everything that happened thereafter. Are you intending to make a causal claim as well? And can you just say more about your thinking along those lines?
Great. It is... I don't know that I'm especially sophisticated in thinking along these lines, although Sam does draw me into argument because he just has a way of getting under my skin. Love him, though I do. My intuition is that we are constantly in the business of making causal claims, and that certain claims otherwise are useful provocations and an argument to muddy the waters and prevent the resolution of the argument. So I think there are causal claims all over in the work of Professor Moyne and in mine as well. A thing to bring out about the engagements that he and I have had this fall is in the way in which Sam's energized moralistic project is the project of critique that I described near the end. It's the project that imagines that calling out the outrages and injustices will bolster the reform imagination, the reform spirit, and lead people to the ramparts. I am, as you could see if you had a chance to look at these unending blog posts and the like, am worried about that on a number of grounds. Not because I don't want the world to get better, maybe even along the same lines that Sam would, but because I'm highly skeptical that, forgive me, this group is well equipped to make the kinds of political judgments that would be necessary to adopt the right tactics to tell the right story. I suspect that us trying to get the story right is the best path for us to do the work in the world that we might want to do. And there's a kind of way in which confidence that the world of the past properly understood, will make the world better in the future, allows me to do that. In some ways, Sam is not confident enough of his own views to just tell the story the way it really was. Some thoughts. I love you, Sam. I do.
Hi, I'm wondering a little bit about the role of the individual in your story. It sounds like there's not much of one, but maybe an individual can be duped into thinking that he has some available agency. And then I'm wondering about someone like Francis Lieber, who seems to have made a big impact on the world.
That's interesting. So there are certainly some characters in this story. I mean, I don't know, William Z. Foster, an amazing character. The late career Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who's less interesting than the early career Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. Some characters in this story who would agree with you that the individual has no agency in a world of forces. It would be a materialist historical explanation. I guess I don't think that that's what I'm doing at all. I think that I may be overplaying individuals. I love the photographs, thus the photographs. I mean, the characters, the organization of these people around the Garland Fund. I don't think that Brown Against the Board comes out the way it does if it's not for the debates that these 12 people are having around a table in Greenwich Village in 1929. This is a story about contingency and human agency, maybe to a fault. Maybe to a fault. So it certainly is a story that engages the idea that social forces and institutions are all there is. And certainly it has those forces and institutions in the story. After all, not everything these agents want to do can be done. Now, it might be that I could find another conference table to explain that. I don't know, the J.P. Morgan or John Rockefeller conference table or the like. But so it's an aim to have both. I'm interested. Yeah, I'll revisit the story to try to bring that out. Thank you, Cynthia.
Was it a case of bad timing that he got his inheritance in the 20s, the lean years, and not the turbulent years? That it was third-party communism, not Popular Front communism? Which makes me wonder whether Hillman was, by the time industrial unionism and Popular Front, I take it, were basically pretty much spent out. So would they have learned different lessons if there had been successes in the 30s rather than failures in the 20s?
Great. We actually have a test case in that, a little laboratory experiment. It's wonderful when history can provide natural experiments. It does so rarely. But there's the Marshall Fund. A man named Lewis Marshall leaves money to a trust, makes Baldwin the director of the trust in the early 30s. It's like the same thing over again. And I think what happens there, and the reason why it's less studied, the 30s have such transformative politics on such a mass scale that this amount of money is not worth attending to. I mean, that is, in some ways, Hillman, Sidney Hillman, having come out of his Brookwood Labor College and Amalgamated Clothing Workers and Garland Fund experience, he's now leading a massive Congress of Industrial Organizations, as to which a couple $100,000, you know, it's not the same thing. So we do have that experiment. It's just, in a way, the lean years helped to produce. I think in a more robust moment, I don't think these 12 people stay around the table as long. They've got things to do. They've got projects to pursue, and they stay around the table because it's so bleak outside the Civic Club on West 12th Street.
Hi, John. Thank you. That was really wonderful, and I feel like I learned a ton about things I thought I already knew a lot about, so I really want to thank you for that. I guess I have a question, and this is about the larger, sort of what we take away about legal history as a whole from this. So you end trying to give us some hope, right, that this there's a way to, you know, that there's something about this story that lets us stave off the feeling of paralysis and hopelessness. And I have to say I'm very sympathetic to that, having, you know, tried to follow a different strand out of this same moment, trying to crack the same nut of the kind of the race class conundrum, which was, you know, the litigation to try to end segregation in unions and jobs. Similarly, not just as a way to access those jobs or those unions, but to try to address this issue of the division in the labor movement and build a stronger labor movement. And that also maybe is less crushed, it kind of petered out because it was really hard. And like you said, you're met at every turn by a counter strategy that seems to put up a roadblock. And so I guess I wonder why. I mean, so first of all, I think when you have a Lost Promises story, it sort of helps you keep your hope because it's a path not taken, and you can always imagine what that path would have looked like. In some ways, it's harder to stay hopeful when the path was actually taken and it just didn't work. And in some ways, it's, you know, it's sort of surprising to end a story in which your actor's hopes get crushed with a message of hope about the law. So I guess I'm curious to hear you talk about what propels you to want to take hope out of that, because I felt the same. Like, I feel like I tried very much to wring what hope I could from, you know, from the story I told to. And I think it's maybe because I'm just an optimistic person and I want to keep at bay the feelings of paralysis and hopelessness. But I guess I'm wondering what, to also invite you to think about, like, what would the story you're telling look like, and what would your conclusion about legal history be if instead you embraced the crushing at the end instead of tried to pull some hope out of it?
Thank you, Sophia. Of course, one of the things I hope is clear is that at the bottom of various stories, one gets to things like one's own temperament, one's own psychology, one's own class status, position in the world, all sorts of things shape the narratives that one drops over facts like this. But it is an unavoidable fact for legal historians of my generation, maybe yours too, so maybe you're much, much, much more youthful, that Brown against the Board started off as triumph stories when I was in college and now has a different cast. And so working through that question strikes me as one of the central projects of legal history in our time. So why end on the hope? Well, maybe what's really driving it is all the things, temperament and the rest. But in addition, one of the things it's too easy to leave out is that the world as we have it isn't the worst it could have been. That is, the counterfactual should include not just the stories of the triumphs not achieved, but the things that could have happened otherwise. So nothing in my story today began to sketch out the world in which there isn't extraordinary heroic resistance by extraordinary, courageous, and brilliant actors. But that's a world which, you know, I think I'm glad I'm not in. So that's some reason to think about the upside.
On that hopeful note.